Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes of working with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we'll be joined by a man described by Rolling Stone as the perfect foil for John Mayer, the 3-time Grammy winner, Bob Reynolds. Bob has worked with a plethora of gifted artists, and today we'll be finding out what he's learned on this journey that he can pass on to young musicians, both from a technical perspective as well as touring and recording. His new album Quartet has just been released, and Bob joins us before a show tonight at the gorgeous Cadogan Hall as part of the London Saxophone Festival. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Bob Reynolds. Thanks for joining us today, Bob. How's it going?
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. So tonight you're playing at the Cadogan Hall, which I was just telling you is such a beautiful venue. I know you've not been there yet.
Yeah.
What have you prepared? What are you going to be playing tonight at this show?
Well, we'll be playing a mix of music from this album that just came out, Quartet, and a couple more recent albums of mine, Guitar Band, Hindsight, and Somewhere in Between. And so this band that I have with me today or tonight is the actual band on the album, Quartet. The name of the album is because this is the first time I've had a band I felt like worthy of actually giving that moniker to. It's sort of a standard jazz practice. It's like I've played plenty of gigs and done things in the past that would be billed as the Bob Reynolds Quartet, or somebody says, what's your band? It's just a go-to thing in jazz, like the such and such trio, the so-and-so's quartet or quintet, and that's fine. But to be truthful, like I've had a lot of experiences in the past where I've gotten to do things that, yes, they're four players and they may be four incredible world-class people, but there's a difference between getting four A-list people in a studio to make a record for a day or two and having it be an actual band that plays frequently, like a real band. And this band that I have with me tonight, it's the guys I've been playing with in Los Angeles in this formation for 2 years, and the bass player and I have been playing together since Berklee College of Music, so 20 years.
So you've got that intuition?
Yes. Yeah. It's all about that sort of interactive chemistry. And, musically, we're all coming from, of course, our own unique places, but we have a really strong overlap and connection of the way that we sort of approach music. So it's a really good feel, and I'm extremely excited to have those guys on the road with me for a couple of weeks playing shows. It's not just my tunes and my music with different sets of people, which can be nice in its own way, but there's nothing quite like developing something as a group. And that's what's happened for me over the past couple of years with these guys, is just we play once a month regularly at a club in Los Angeles called the Baked Potato. And you just start to develop things and a sort of like a shorthand, like a collective shorthand for things. So it's really fun.
And you can't manufacture that into someone.
It's true. And it's not something that you can write down, in sheet music with just the right instructions or whatnot. It's all about getting the right individuals you want them because they do what they do as an individual, but then also people who are serving the music first, not themselves first. What is the song? What is the shape? What does it need?
Yeah.
And having the people that know that sometimes what the song absolutely needs is not them or not you at the moment, right? Like having that kind of wherewithal.
When you've worked with people in the past and you've had to deal with that situation where maybe someone is playing when it's not what the song needs, how do you go about communicating that to someone in a diplomatic way?
That's a good question. let's see. I suppose my go-to is to just look for ways to think about what it is that I'm after, what's not happening that I wish were happening, what's the result that I'm looking for, and is there a way that I could frame that? This also depends on the always depends who is the person and how long have I known them and what's the context, but generally I'd be looking for a way to frame any sort of instruction or question in such a way that it was not pointed as like a at the other person as like, yeah, ooh, you're doing something wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I would just try to look for, you know, a way to, you know, describe the fact that something's not there yet. And look, generally, when playing with the best or better, with wonderful musicians, that's not even a pride. It's not an issue. Either you get what you get, you get what you want, and you didn't, or you get something you didn't know you wanted, and it's better. Or if you have some sort of adjustment you want to make, the real pros, like, it's not, they're not going to have a bruised ego because you say, yeah, it's not quite there yet. You know, like, I remember the first album that I recorded as a leader in a studio, an album called Can't Wait for Perfect, and a stellar band on that, Aaron Goldberg on piano, Eric Harland, an incredible jazz drummer on drums, Ruben Rogers on bass, and a guitarist named Mike Moreno. I mean, some of the heaviest dudes in New York. And there was some things we were doing where the drum beats weren't the way I was hearing them in my head. And I felt like, how do I tell Eric Harland, like, that it's not right? It's not that it was bad, but it wasn't what I, you know, I'm in there making my record and I had a specific idea, partially because at that point I had programmed a lot of the music, like in, you know, software. I had little beats in mind that I, and we were in the studio 2 days, and I always remember, like, it kind of took the first day to just get comfortable, and it was the second day that we really rolled through stuff, and it was something either I said or something that happened, maybe it was something Eric played, and I said, ooh, that, like, that thing, I want that on the other tune, and I remember him going, oh, okay, oh, you want that E, like, referring to himself, he's like, I see, he's like, okay, and it was just one little thing, and then all of a sudden he knew what I was looking for, and he just made a subtle shift and boom,
and everything locked into place.
Exactly. Nice, exactly. Nice. So he was just kind of, you know, and I know this feeling from being on that side of it too. You're trying to figure out what the person that you're working with or for, you know, wants, and it's a bit of a dance between you don't want to play in such a way that you're trying to play what you think somebody else wants to hear. You want to, but there is this sort of almost unspoken negotiation where you're just trying to figure out, is this, am I on the right path? You know, so it's, a lot of it is just sort of these intangible cues, you know, you're looking for subtle signals, like, is this working, is this not working? I don't know, that's a really
it's interesting
wandering answer.
With Quartet, with the album Quartet, I'm listening today, beautiful album, a couple of questions on that. The first one, what did you specifically want to achieve on that album that you hadn't done on other albums? What did you want to do different? If you were having pre-production meetings, whatever it might be, what did you want to either avoid or do more of in that particular?
Yeah, great question. At the time that I decided to record it, it was sort of a few months, I think, into our residency in LA, where we'd played enough that I felt like there's something here as a band. I was feeling like, whoa, I kind of just want to document some of these things that are going on, you know, because it had gone beyond what the charts said, and we were doing things. So that was really the only impetus. And also, we're playing, we all function really well in front of an audience in a live environment. That was where, so it was a mix of elements. I mean, the album before it, of mine, which is called Guitar Band, I recorded that at a club in LA live in front of an audience, and it was live in a club, and the recording came, I didn't plan for it to be a record, but it sounded so good when I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. So I'd had that experience, and so I thought, I want to get that same team. There's a guy named Alex Chaloff who did all the video and audio for that, and I was like, I'm gonna get Alex and I want to get this band and find, I don't want to go back to the club, but I want to find something where we can record live but be in a studio but not use the studio gear. So what we did was we found the studio in Los Angeles where actually Metallica recorded the Black Album.
Really?
Yeah, and it's a big, there's a big room, you know, because it's all, and we did it all on video too. So we did a whole day, and half of it was just us, and then in the evening we brought in an audience, and we just did one set in front of that audience. And the idea was we'll take the best of whatever it happens to be. And so I think the album ended up being a 50-50 split, four songs with, four songs without the audience. But the thing is, it's all live. Whether the audience was there or not, this was all live. There's no overdubs. There's no cuts. They were just live takes caught right there. And they weren't, when I say we're not using the board, meaning the entire, you know, studio part that you think of, not the room that the musicians are in, but this, you know, the mixing board. We didn't use any of it. It all took place with the sort of mobile recording rig out in the room.
So what was the secret of that? So actually, it leads me on to my next question. So I was listening to all your stuff this week, including some stuff you've done with Snarky Puppy, and I could start listening to the songs and go, wow, this is a lush, rich sounding recording.
Yeah.
And at the end, there's a load of clapping. It's like, wow, you did this. It's like, what? Where did that come from? And so what is the secret to such high quality live recordings?
Well, that's, the secret weapon is Alex.
It is Alex. Okay.
He's sort of messed me up now in a good way, and that once I've now heard, like, he's, how can I put this? He's just, whatever it is and how he's capturing the sounds, both just of me personally on my instrument and of the group, it's like a realization of a dream, what I am at. Like, this is what I think it should sound like, and why is it always so difficult to get it to sound like this? So I'm sure it's a combination of he uses really great ribbon microphones. He has a connection with a company called AEA that manufactures these wonderful ribbon mics. So all of the microphones are beautiful ribbon mics. And he is a drummer himself by background. So he's an audio guy first, even though the videos that he shoots and his team shoots are incredible. You know, I've done work with videographers before, and they've got multiple cameras, and the audio, you can tell the audio is almost secondary for them. And so what you end up with is a video that might look good and subpar audio. Alex gets the audio straight from the beginning. I mean, that's priority one. So anyway, there's something about how he's, I don't know what it is he's doing, but he captures it right, and lush is a great way to put it. And it just, I want more and more that live feeling. So I don't want to go into a studio and put everybody in headphones in separate rooms, and you know, you're in a dry, dead room, and then you record and there's no, you know, you might be able to see each other a little bit, but there's no audience. It's clearly not, I mean, it's live in that you might be making the music in real time, but, you know. And then you spend all this time mixing to try to put the air back in it. What I mean by the air is just that sense of space around the musicians, around the music. And if you go back to the older recordings, you know, I'm thinking 50s, 60s, you know, classic Columbia recordings, whether we're talking about Miles Davis and that classic band, or Frank Sinatra being in the room with an orchestra at Capitol Records. Frank Sinatra didn't overdub after the orchestra played. He wanted to be in the room with the orchestra. And you'll get something that way that you're never going to get the other way. You're going to get the bleed. You're going to get all these things. What does that mean? It means you're going to get the mistakes too, if whatever you want to call a mistake, that's going to be in there as well.
Do you think that the fear of bleed is kind of overrated a bit? Because it's in the past, like I've had other people on here and even recently, but so, you know, like a lot of studio engineers avoid bleed, but actually I think it gives it so much character.
Well, I agree. It depends on the project, you know, and it depends on the type of the music, and again what the outcome you're searching for is. So it's about matching up the process with the desired result, I think. So, you know, if John Mayer's spending a lot of time in the studio he's making a different kind of record than you know, it's like I'm trying to record a band that plays as four people together live, and the most special thing that can come from that band of four people is the things that are going to happen, the chemistry that's going to, the unknown.
The intuition.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's not the kind of thing that you want to do piecemeal. It has to be done. So again, if I'm trying to match those two up, then it doesn't make sense to do it really any other way than that.
Cool. Okay, so you grew up in New Jersey, is that right?
A little bit. I was born in New Jersey. I was only there through like second grade, so I don't have.
And where did you move to?
I grew up with my mom. My parents got divorced when I was two, so we bounced around a lot. I went to upstate New York. I lived in Ithaca, which is near a big college called Cornell University. And at some point, the weather just got too cold and gray for her, and we had some extended family in Florida, and we went down there for a Christmas holiday visit one time, and she was like, we're moving. And so we moved to Florida, to Jacksonville, Florida, when I was about 12 years old.
And We often ask what the motivation to take up a musical instrument, and I think you've got possibly the best answer for this ever. So for my research, is it right that you were producing and directing home movies?
Yes.
And you wanted to be Steven Spielberg, per se, and you wanted on the credits, you know, written by, you know, with your name, directed by Bob Reynolds, etc., and the only one that you couldn't have was music by.
That's
and
true.
And so you took up a musical instrument, is that true?
That is absolutely that is amazing. True, yeah. I was making all these little home movies, you know, getting my brother and my neighbor, you know, my friends to be in it. And, yeah, I was doing all of the thing. I was really, like, just infatuated with the process, like, of movies. When I would watch the credits, well, I was maybe the only, I don't know, 10, 11, 12-year-old who was, like, interested in watching the credits. And I was fascinated by, you know, you just got done watching this thing. And then look at all these people that it took to do that. And I don't know. There was something about that that was – it wasn't like – I don't want to say I was motivated by the credits. It's just the act of – I was really – I wanted to be a film director. That's what I wanted to do. But I also had a strong inclination towards the way that music worked in storytelling, like how it served, like what a role it played. I was really keenly aware of that on some level from an early age. And so I was just fascinated by it, but I knew nothing about – music on a technical level. I'd never had any lessons anyway. So
it was John Williams quite a...
John Williams was huge for me. I'm a child of the 80s, you know? That's where I... Yeah, exactly. Spielberg films and John Williams music. I mean, you know, from Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark and whatnot to, like, Jurassic Park, which I'd seen with my younger brother probably a dozen or two dozen times in one summer. I mean, I just...
Summer 93.
Yeah, that's how it was. Yeah, that's about it. So that's what got me... Yeah, so when I was making these movies, exactly, it was, like, written by Bob Reynolds, directed by Bob Reynolds, all these credits, and then it would say, like, music, Vanilla Ice, or something. You know, whatever was on the radio, I was, like, trying to dub things from the radio. I mean, it was nonsense.
So what qualities of John Williams' music are apparent in your music, if at all?
Themes. I hope. Strong themes. So, okay, yes, I play the saxophone. I don't compose on the saxophone.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever... I could be wrong about this, but nothing comes to my mind that I've ever actually composed on the saxophone. So, really, for me, that means that I don't want to write something that is a byproduct of a thing I can do on the saxophone. There are many things that I can do on that instrument, you know, that I've got a dexterity and facility to do certain things, but I couldn't sing them, or I wouldn't necessarily sing them. They're, you know what I mean? So I'm interested in strong melodies and strong, like, harmonic, how can I phrase this? Like the emotions that are generated from the way that harmony works, you know, the way that one chord relates to another chord relates to another. I always like to say, and I think I stole this from Pat Metheny, like in an interview somewhere, but it's a great idea. He said, and I may be misattributing it to him, but the idea is that, you know, if you sit down and play a chord on a piano or a guitar, it's a singular event. It's a chord. What is it? I mean, it might be major, it might be minor, but it's just that. But then you add a second chord and now you have a relationship. And it's that thing, because that's when that's what you're looking for, is that relation. If you're looking for that thing actually that's happening between the two chords. I am, anyway.
But given that a lot of your, well, actually all of your music is instrumental, are you sitting down trying to convey a emotion that some other songwriters would convey through lyrics, or... is it just what kind of comes out of you and you just capture it?
The second one.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever sat down with, like, an emotion in mind. And then, you know, at this point now I've got this is the 10th record. I don't know. I've written a fair amount of material. And I know where my leanings are. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to lean towards a certain flavor and maybe perhaps to the melancholy side of things. But that being said, like, I don't sit down and go, I want to write a happy song. I mean, if anything, I might have a tempo in mind. I'd like to write something that's up or, you know, or down, you know what I mean? And sometimes that can be like, all right, I know I want to do something in that area of tempo. And maybe it's like I find some drum loop, or I program something that interests me, and then that becomes the first idea generator. That speed, that tempo, and maybe that drum beat, then I hear a bass line, or I hear something, and that leads to the next thing and the next thing. But I never am like, you know what, I want to write a song.
It's more just like
I sit down. One of my favorite things to do is I just sit at the piano and I just start to noodle and like where am I right now? Maybe it's one chord, and I'll sit there and just listen to it ring out and go, all right, what am I feeling the next place should be? And then I'll play something like, nope, that's not it, and try five different things, and maybe I get that next chord right, and then it's like, ooh, I like that. And I'll just sit there back and forth between the two, and I sort of go from there.
So this might sound a slightly trivial question, but out of curiosity, so at what point does the song title come in? Because there's obviously no lyrics to refer to, so is that a reflection of the music at the end, or is this, where does that come from?
It's a great question. It's always a hard thing for me, titles for instrumental music. I've done some film scoring, and one of my favorite things about it is the titles, because it's instrumental music, but the titles present themselves fairly obviously, because they tend to be related to dialogue in a scene. And so I always found like that was so fun, because like I'd write a cue and then I would like know what to call that cue because it was around a moment. So when it's just completely instrumental, I generally keep a long running list of titles. I mean, in notebooks or now on my phone, I have just, because I'll get an idea, I'll just hear something and think, ooh, that's a good title. Maybe I'll use that at some point. I try to just jot it down so I have a bank of titles. And then when I have a song, then I'm like looking for the title that matches what I feel the mood of that song is. And so sometimes I'll look back through that catalog of ideas, and most of the time I'm like, oh, that stinks, that's rubbish, you know, whatever. That I don't like it. I'm like, wow, how did I ever think that was a good title idea? Sometimes they sit for a long time as just untitled one, untitled
really?
Two. Oh yeah. It tends to be rough for me to come up with the titles.
Yeah, so difficult.
But it happens after the song. That's true.
What do you do with your creative outlet when you're working with other musicians who are a bit more dictatorial? So you're more of a session player rather than playing with your own stuff. Is that a frustration, having to play within yourself sometimes? And how do you deal with that?
You sort of take a look at the gig for what it is and say, what's this context? And if I've said yes to it, you know, then I've decided to put myself there. To give an example, like playing in a horn section for Usher, who's big, like, production type artist. Like, Usher's a really, like, his thing is a show. It's tight. It's a very tight thing. There's not a lot of leeway, right?
Yeah.
It's very tight. There's no place in there where I would actually even be thinking, like, where do I get to do me? Like, doing me is just, like, showing up and nailing whatever my part of that thing is.
And is that part often written for you, or is it something you have to kind of transcribe from a record, or...?
It's like, I wouldn't say it's written. I mean, this specifically, the stuff I had done with Usher is not written. It's just tends to be, there might be a horn line in place, or maybe you're making it up as a section. Sometimes it's that. It's kind of like, you know, you've got a few, somebody's sort of taking the lead and you're coming up with it. So there can be some collaboration. It's a little bit different every time. With a band like Snarky Puppy, it's very collaborative, and yet also, you know, Michael League, who's the bass player and band leader, I mean, he, at the end of the day, he's the guy who says what it's going to be, but he's very open along the way when we're creating something as a group for the first time. There's a lot of openness to it, but at a certain point,
it needs someone to say,
somebody has to say it's going to be this or that. Yeah, exactly. So
cool. And that Usher, you did one Usher gig. Did you play for Bill Clinton?
We did something at the Hollywood Bowl. It was for a charity or a foundation. It was a big event type thing. Yeah, but I forget what – I mean, Usher and the Clintons knew each other already at that point. It was a cover of the Joe Cocker cover of A Little Help from My Friends.
Yeah.
It was just like one of
– Was it just one song you did, huh?
It was one or two. I can't recall. No, maybe a couple of Usher's songs also.
You don't strike me as someone who gets nervous and stuff like that, but – must have been a bit strange playing for that audience. Do you ever find yourself thinking about who's in the audience? If you've got like an ex-president, you know, and that kind of thing. Is that a bit of a strange one?
Yeah.
Does that take you out of the focus of what you should be doing a little bit?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, not in a way where it's like, I can't do it.
No.
But sometimes, you know, you have something like that and it's sort of hard not to just sort of go, this is surreal. Like, what? I'm at the Hollywood Bowl playing with Usher for Bill Clinton. Like, what is happening here right now? But not in such a way that I like can't do what I need to do, you know.
How were Bill and Hillary? Did you get a chance to meet them?
I didn't actually. No.
You talked previously in another interview I heard that around early jobs that you did and the fact that you had to kind of string jobs together so you could afford to tour with Jonah Smith. Is that right?
Yeah, you've done your homework.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So out of interest, do you think any of those jobs you learned skills that could be transferred even subconsciously to what you're doing now? Was there some value in that you've transferred?
I think there's absolutely intangible value, like that I'm not exactly sure how to say it's a direct line, but I know there's value there. I mean, I'm trying to think if there's any sort of specific through line. I was talking to somebody after a show the other night, a younger musician who's at a place right now where he's just feeling pretty frustrated, you know, saxophone player and good guy. I've known him for a couple of years and good player and just feeling stuck and feeling frustrated. And basically I was talking about those jobs, those years, and how frustrating they were for me when I was going through them and how glad I am now that I had them and went through them.
You know, hard work is the reward kind of thing.
Yeah. It's just sort of also like, I remember having those jobs and thinking, how come I'm not the guy getting to do, I have this cool gig or that cool gig. How come I'm not, I'm, you know, in my own mind, I'm like, I'm good enough. I should be doing that. Blah, blah, blah. You know, just like feeling frustrated and jealous and I'm working at Red Bull. Like, this is embarrassing. What am I doing? And I remember specifically one time, they had introduced these Mini Cooper cars. I don't know if you've ever seen them around London. They're, you know, driving around with the Red Bull can on the back.
Oh, yeah.
And I was with you worked in shifts, so me and a friend. And it was a cool gig in that most everybody doing that job at the time, we were all sort of aspiring, struggling and aspiring artists, actors, dancers, filmmakers, and musicians working that job. So you're kind of traipsing around New York with, you know, a kindred spirit, you know?
Yeah.
But I was on the West Side Highway, and I'll never forget this. We were parked somewhere. We were supposed to go in and sample Red Bull to like a guy who owned a Subway sandwich shop or something. And I'm sitting there in the car, and across the street, I see some really famous jazz musicians, a bass player named Dave Holland and his band with Chris Potter, one of my idols on the saxophone, and Billy Kills. They're walking into a rehearsal space on the other side of the street, and I just like slunk down in my chair. Not that the only one who would have known me was Chris, and I was like, oh God, I'm mortified. Please don't let him see me. You know, I was just embarrassed. And now I look back on it and I feel silly, but at the time I just felt like I'm not cutting it. I should be making all of my living from playing the saxophone, and I would oscillate. Like, I'd have these jobs, and then I would go to, all right, I'm going to just teach music lessons and play wedding gigs, and then at least I can say I'm making all of my income from playing the saxophone.
Yeah.
And then I would do that for a while, and I would just want to – it was soul-crushing.
Yeah.
And I would be like, screw that. I'm going back to just doing the job that has nothing to do with the saxophone, and then any music I make is music I want to make with people I want to make it with. So there were a lot of years of sort of trying to balance those two things. And honestly – just stay in the game. That was sort of the advice I was giving to this guy. It's like, you know, a huge portion of it is just staying in the game. It's a bit of a war of attrition, and it's amazing how as time goes by, the world and the professional world you may work in gets smaller and smaller, and you know more people. And if you can stick around and keep focused and not lose, you know, your desire for what you're doing, I mean, that's a huge part of it. So those jobs, They kept me around, you know? They kept me from having to pack up and leave New York. I could pay my rent. I could stay there. I could be around for opportunities to develop, things that just take time.
Great answer, thank you. And you've written and played on like hundreds of songs. And what is the creative well you go to when you've got a blank sheet of paper in front of you? So talk about writer's block and that kind of thing. Is there anything you particularly do? I know you talked about sitting at a piano and seeing and noodling. Anything else?
Yeah, it's a good question too. I can think of a couple. So one of them is when I sit at the piano, very often I'm instantly annoyed at my own stuff. I have places I go, and so it's just annoying. I'm like, oh, I've been here so many times before. I can't believe I'm playing this again, you know? Mm. And so one of the things I'll do to help get myself unstuck is play. I'll pull up like the chord changes to a jazz standard, and I don't have like great piano skills, right? But even to just slowly kind of march my way through the chord changes and figure out how to navigate another composer's harmonic choices almost inevitably brings me at least to one new chord. It might not be a new chord, but just a new something, a new voice. And all I'm looking for is the one sound that makes that little thing inside go, ooh, that's interesting. Mm. What is that? And then I try to follow that thread. It doesn't have to be at the piano. Sometimes it could be a sound in, you know, I've over the years used Reason and Logic and, you know, different composing softwares and stuff. So it could be anything in there in the sound, but it could be a pad that I played two notes, but the way that that pad sounds, all of a sudden I've got a stream of ideas. You know, it could be a drum loop. It could be just something to trigger myself. When I was doing some film work and on really tight deadlines and feeling definitely that blank page thing and also like I have to make something, what I would often do is just look to steal from things that I would take music that was already produced. So specifically, I can remember like some scoring work that I was doing and I just felt like, God, I was so stuck because everything I started to do just felt so pedestrian and elementary and like unfinished. Mm-hmm. And I just was blocked, totally blocked. So I started I had about 10 or 12 different cues from composers and other things that I liked, that I just loved the finished product, mm-hmm. you know, the sound of it. And I just started taking those things and putting them against the scene that I was composing to until I found the one that had the right like feel, emotion. Yeah. And then I would work backwards from that, the same way I might from copying a jazz saxophone solo to learn it myself. I would just start deconstructing what are the elements in here? How can I'm not trying to rip it off and play the exact same thing, but just using it as like, oh, that might be like, ooh, okay, the way that he did this, I can do that, with this thing. And that would get me off to the races. And lastly, I would say in a related way is like a lot of times my compositions have been influenced by pop music. I mean, with a broad brush. I mean, everything from Daft Punk to Steve Reich to, you know, nice. Aaron Copland to Thomas Newman, the film composer, to,
you're going to Radiohead as well, aren't you?
Radiohead, but, yeah, sure.
So,
yeah.
So you mentioned an album of theirs, which is kind of slightly overlooked, but I really love. Is Amnesiac. Mm-hmm. You particularly like that album, don't you? And they started going down the jazz route. Is anything from radio music, do you think, that has influenced you specifically?
Oh, totally.
That you've been able to transfer to the jazz world, and how?
Totally. One of the things I loved when I discovered Radiohead was how they already were using chords that you were more likely to find in the jazz world than you were in the pop world.
Really?
But they were using them in such a way that, you know, didn't sound anything like jazz, okay? But you take a song like Everything in Its Right Place, and the way that they're manipulating major chords in a non-diatonic way, okay? That's something that I remember hearing that and being like, whoa. I can't recall what key the song is actually in, but it's basically they've got flat 2 minor, and there's flat 6 minor, and flat... There's all these... borrowed from other parallel major or minor. It's like you can go down a rabbit hole of theory, but at the end of the day, a lot of it is, and I put a video on my YouTube channel about this called, I think I called it like Every Melody Note Works with Every Bass Note. Mm-hmm. And it's just the idea that if you go down the chromatic scale and you take a single note and you play it up top, you can work your way to every note you can find chords that will make the two notes work in between.
Right.
So something I got from Radiohead, you know, if you think of that song, Everything in Its Right Place, dee doo 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 dee 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 dee, I'm not going to sing the whole thing, but you know, there's a, you can hit this like, play the note C, and underneath that they've got like C with E flat under it, so C is the sixth, and then D flat under it, so C becomes the major seventh, and then C minor, and now that's the root, you know. And the way that the colors shift around that, that was something that really like inspired me and kind of led me down a lot of different ways. And then I would just try doing that myself, like moving static chords around and finding all of the, okay, let me take this one note, what are all the major chords that can work under it, and which ones do I like the best, and in which order, and things of that nature.
So let's talk about some collaborations. You've worked with, so someone that we always get asked actually a lot to try and get on this podcast is Pino Palladino.
I've only played with him a little bit. I don't know him well at all, but we did play together a couple times when I was working with John Mayer.
What are his unique qualities? What is as a bassist?
I mean, you know, I hope I run into him at some point soon, because he's living in Los Angeles now. I actually saw him play at a small club recently. I mean, he plays exactly what needs to be played and no more. Maybe no more. I mean, he just plays the right notes at the right time. You know, there's not, he's not playing, he's functioning like a bass player in the truest sense of the word. He is holding down that bass part. He's playing just these gorgeous big round fat root notes, you know, a lot of the time. And then every so often though, he does, you know, if you look up especially like videos of him on tour with D'Angelo, even like 10 years ago, I forget what they called that band, but after the Voodoo album, you know, and it's like he's just laying down something so funky, and then he'll just one time he'll pull out some little thing, just a little thing, just once, and it, you go, oh my gosh, you know. But it's not flashy, you know, he's an anchor, and it's just, it's so solid and so groovy. I don't really have the vocabulary to describe what it is that he might be doing, but all you need to do is listen to the album Voodoo by D'Angelo. I mean, that kind of just changed the game, the way that he and Questlove interact together. I mean, and how he can play so behind the beat but not have it be dragging, and you know, that's a team effort there. But I mean, Pino's just, it's about the best thing I can say. I mean, he just plays the right thing at the right time all the time.
Okay, so John Mayer, how did your relationship with John Mayer work when you collaborated with him?
It started off just, how did it start? We, first of all, we went to Berkeley together. And that's where I met him first, back in, I guess it would have been 1997. We're the same age, we're the same grade at Berkeley. I met him at a very late night recording session, one that started at 2:30 or 3 in the morning, if I recall.
Started.
Wow, okay. Yeah, because the way it worked at Berkeley back then, they didn't have a lot of studio space, recording studio space.
Book time.
And they were running classes all through the day. So the only open time was in the late hours, right?
Yeah.
And generally, if people were the people who were there to study engineering, they had projects they had to complete for engineering projects. And, you know, then everybody else had projects, they had to get their music recorded. So somebody said, hey, will you do this late night session for my live to two track project? Live to two meaning it's not going to be a multi-track environment. We're going to record live to two track stereo. That's like a starter project in the music production and engineering. And so it was a guy who lived on my floor in the dorms, and I said, yes. And that ended up being the session that John Mayer was one of the guitar players on. And I did it sort of reluctantly. Like, I didn't know any of the guys doing it, and it started late, and I was, you know, I mean, I was only a freshman, but again, I remember thinking, I don't know, I mean, how come none of the really cool jazz guys are calling me to record? I guess I'll go record with this dude down the hall, you know, whatever. And it was super fun, but I didn't think anything of it, you know, other than that. But that's where I met John, and I somewhere have a cassette tape still of the song we recorded. It was called Depends, which he co-wrote with his buddy Clay Cook, and it was they named it after the adult diaper called Depends. Yeah, John was very much in his Charlie Hunter, heavy in being influenced by Charlie Hunter at that time, and I think he was even playing the same kind of guitar that Charlie Hunter plays. And there's a song on his album on John's first album, Room for Squares, called Neon.
Right.
And I think Neon is very closely related to this little jam that we did for that project.
Got it.
Anyway.
But that version that you got on cassette,
yeah.
has it been heard before? Has it been released before? Is it just something you've got for yourself at eBay one day?
it's something I have, and you know, John's heard it, but it's not something that's out there.
Yeah.
No,
interesting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people probably like to hear that.
Yeah, it's a private archive thing. But then 10 years went by and his career blew up and we stayed in touch a little bit. We weren't like good friends at Berklee. I mean, literally that was the only time I met him. There were a couple other overlapping moments. But 10 years later, I had seen him. One time I went home to Florida in Jacksonville and happened to notice he was like playing a big arena show there, and I got in touch with him like, hey man, you know, like I'm gonna be in town, any chance I could get a ticket? And he hooked me up and I went back, I heard his band, I went backstage, and that was years before I started working with him. But then years later, I had just gotten married and I was back to New York from our honeymoon about 5 or 6 days, and I don't remember exactly what happened, but I landed on John's website, he had just put out the album Continuum. And I was checking it. It was so great. I was just listening to some clips. Saw he was playing at Webster Hall, and again, you know, said, "Hey man, I just got back in town. If you're around, you know, love to connect or whatever." And he emailed back. And he was like, "Come to the show. What are you doing next year?" And I thought, okay. And so I didn't tell my wife, but I surprised her. I took her to the show at Webster Hall, and then we went backstage afterwards, and I figured I'd let John ask, because like I said, we were just 6 days back from the honeymoon. And so he said, you know, I have introduced him to my wife, Nora, and he was like, "Hi, Nora, nice to meet you. Do you mind if I borrow your husband for the year?" And the thing is, he was looking to make some changes and just wondered if I would join the band. And it wasn't like a thing where my audition happened 10 years earlier at 2:30 in the morning. So feel like that's a big lesson in and of itself, you know. You just no way you would have known all that time, but that's how. And so he tells the story, you know, he remembers it his way of remembering it was like, oh my gosh, like I don't want, you know, whatever he thinks. No, just like at that time at Berklee, I was playing little concerts around school, recitals. Let's say just my name would be on flyers because it's a very, you know, if you're decent and you're playing jazz there, you're going to maybe play a little bit more than a guy. Like he was another guitar player in a sea of guitar players just as a freshman. That's really all there is to it. And he was just getting going on his thing and figuring out, you know, he didn't really sing yet or was just starting. So at that time, I had a little bit more. He was aware of me as a presence in the landscape. And so I think the things just added up together and he was like, oh man, you always had like these great ears. And it was like, oh, Bob could just play anything. But I don't know. He has his little stories. But my point is that just that, that was, if there was an audition, it was that. It was just, it happened 10 years prior. And then, so in terms of collaboration, I mean, I loved his music. I mean, I was like, I grew up loving, I mean, I'm a huge Sting fan, right. And some of my favorite of Sting's work includes the saxophonist Branford Marsalis, and I loved that. That's like one of my favorite things in the world musically. Mm. And so to play with John, I saw that as like that could be my version of that to be that in John's world. And I really think that's kind of what it ended up being. And it started out with just playing the specific horn parts that were on the record from like Heavier Things and a little bit of Continuum, and then it developed like rehearsal by rehearsal. Well, there's just the rehearsals at the beginning, and then you just go off into shows and there's no more rehearsals. But night after night, you know, it might be like one night we would do hey, let's pull out Neon, and he would just look at me and like play, and I would do it and it would go well, so then that would happen again, or we would do this song or we do that song. So over time it developed. And it got more collaborative to the point where the last tour I did with him, there was a song we were doing every night called Do You Know Me? And we would do this very extended, almost like Dave Matthews Band-esque kind of soprano and acoustic guitar. Or what was he playing? Like a little, he plays a small guitar. It's not a ukulele, but it's like a, I don't know, it looks like a ukulele.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a really great time and a lot of great collaboration. And then I was very fortunate, I did a record called Somewhere in Between of my own, which we recorded in New York. And I'd asked John if he would play guitar on it, but I specifically asked him to do it under a pseudonym because I didn't want him to think I was after his name. I really wanted him to play guitar on it. I wanted to get a little bit of what we did in his shows, the trading, the sort of that, again, that sort of conversational element on a couple of my songs or on my record. And so I was like, let's just, you know, I knew that the Marsalis brothers often recorded under pseudonyms like in the 80s when they could, for contractual reasons.
Right.
But John was so cool. He was like, no, this is killing. He's like, if I'm going to do this, I want it to count.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he was like, absolutely, we're doing it. I'll put my name on it. But I love playing with that guy, man. He's a monster musician and he's one of the smartest people that I've ever met. He's a really smart guy, really smart.
Generally, or in regards to music, like what specifically?
The way that he is able to see the big picture and the way he's been able to build, shape, and reshape his career and the moves he's made strategically, the way he thinks about the way he understands his audience, the way he communicates with his audience, the way from everything from the way he'll do a set to talk to the audience to whether it was back when he was writing blog posts or he wrote articles for Esquire magazine. He's brilliant with words. He's so good. I mean, his songs the proof is in the pudding. He's got an incredible way with words. He's just so clever, and I don't mean that like in a pejorative fashion. I mean, like he's the way he thinks about things. It's like, oh, that is so smart, man, to make that move right now to do this. Or even in a musical sense on stage, where it'd be like he had such a great intuition for how to pace the set. Like, okay, we just got really open and jammy for like 9 minutes on Wheel. Okay, boom, let's go right into Georgia, play it like 3 minutes and done. Like we need to go right into Clear Cut and Dried pop tune right now. Boom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a sense of that. I just learned so much from him.
And so sets were made up sometimes on the spot. So
yeah.
There
was always a set list
we had,
but he would definitely, there'd be audibles, you know, he would get on the private microphone kind of thing where he could just talk to the band and be like, skip whatever, we're going straight to such and such, you know?
Nice.
But yeah, he's a deep guy, man. He's a really, really smart guy and a really generous and genuine dude. I mean, nothing but great things to say about him.
He's got his tune called Vultures, right?
It's
such a tune. And on the record, I don't think there's any sax, but you played on it live. Is that
yeah,
right?
And there's a re-release. There's a limited edition that they released of Continuum that was like the album plus, I want to say, 6 live cuts from that tour. And on that version of Vultures, I am on it.
And is that the live version? Or
the
is
live
it,
version.
Yeah. So with that, did he give you free reign to do whatever you wanted? Or
yes.
Did he give you okay.
Yeah. No, though again, it's the same thing I'm looking for when I'm putting my bands together. You know, you want to get somebody in that because you want them to do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time in the incarnation of the band that he had, there was a drummer named J.J. Johnson, who one of my favorite drummers on the planet. He's been out with the Derek Trucks, Susan Tedeschi Trucks band for years now. And so I think it was Vultures where it kind of became this breakdown with like sax and drums. There's a version from Austin City Limits that's still up on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that was just basically a breakdown. It was just he would throw it to me and JJ, and there was no instruction. But I think what was cool is like, you know, whatever my instincts worked for him as well. You know what I mean? It was like I always try to, my approach is just, I'm a listener first, you know, player second. So I'm looking to play things that I would want to hear or also want to hear. Again, it's not like, okay, I've got my breakdown moment. So here's where I'm going to put in all the John Coltrane changes and substitute harmony, blah, blah, blah. I just want to get in the groove, man. So it's just about playing with JJ at that moment in time and trying to take the energy of the song where it is and take it to where I know it's needs to go, and that's all I'm really thinking about, you know.
Cool. What specifically would someone learn from working with John that they wouldn't learn from working with anyone else?
Wow. That's a good... I mean, I feel sort of like a lot of the things that I was just raving about.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked with a bunch of people, and John is, you know, people would ask me when I was doing that, like, oh, who's his musical director? Well, he's his musical director.
Is he, right?
Yeah, I mean, so again, he's very thoughtful and strategic. And those words sometimes I don't mean them to sound like, you say strategic and it sounds like a dirty word. I just mean thoughtful. No, he's so thoughtful. Yeah. Again, big picture, little picture, really good at knowing all the small details that are important, but also being able to detach from that, zoom out, find the bigger picture. You know, whether it's a song, a solo, a set, an album, a tour, or, you know, a particular time in his career. You know, I can look at some of it without, these aren't his words, but I even look at some of it as like, okay, he was at Berkeley, he wanted to be a blues guitar player. He's a white kid from Connecticut, and there were tons of guitar players at Berkeley that could probably play circles around him. You know what I mean? He discovered he had a knack for writing songs and went down this whole thing and had some successful albums. Then he took a left turn maybe, and he did the trio thing with Steve and Pino, and like went out and earned himself a whole new audience of like 40-year-old males who, you know what I mean, who might have thought, oh, bubblegum pop guy. Yeah. And then he was able to circle back to sort of one of his initial loves, but he built this audience first that would follow him, and then he added a new audience, okay, and then, you know, folded that into Continuum, and then like he's done it again recently. He sort of went off the grid for a while and then reappeared now he's in the Grateful Dead. I mean, they call it Dead and Company. And he's gone out, and a lot of people were probably like, ooh, like Deadheads, right? Probably like, ooh, John Mayer, maybe I'm not a fan of him. And now he's like earned himself a whole new, I mean, that, I again, this is just me from the outside looking in, but I feel like, you know, there's some smart moves being played. Like he's really looking at the big picture. And look how long his career, I mean, he's been going. Like, what, the Beatles were a band for 7 years, right? It's not easy to stay in the game, stay relevant, you know, and he's able to do that all and like play the music he wants to make the way he wants to make it. And it's not about like dance moves or costumes or lights. It was always just about the music. So he's trained his audience from the beginning to be with him, you know, whichever direction he goes. I don't know if that's something
that's a great answer. So in regards to yourself, when you play at your own shows, it's a very reflective question, this one.
Okay.
Who do you become on stage that you aren't off stage?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Who do I become on stage that I'm not off stage? Wow, man. Well, in some sense, I feel like I'm trying actually to get the two to match up as much as possible, in that, you know, it's not I don't want to ever like adopt a personality. I don't have like, I go on stage and now I become this other entity. So in a certain way, I would say over time, I'm almost trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to become more fully myself on stage. And
what are you holding back though from yourself currently, if you're not quite there yet, or what have you done in the past?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a little bit of I think I always deal with a little bit of like, oh, what I should play. I feel like I should play something. Who's in the audience, or what's going on right now? I should, I should flex these muscles, or I should do this, or I should do that. You know, I felt that a lot years ago when I was still living in New York, like. I'd be playing a small club and some musician that I respected would walk in the back or something, or I'd be scanning the, you know, and that would lead me to play
for that person.
Yeah. Like, in a way that I maybe was capable of playing, but it wasn't the sincerest form of me because it was a little bit contrived to make a choice to do a, you know, oh, that guy just walked in. I'm going to play. I'm going to really just decide to lay it down and play fat, you know, these kinds of things, which are decisions that take you out of the moment, take you out of the sincerity of the moment. So I've often struggled with that, and I feel like over time I've gotten a little bit better at restraining those impulses and staying and being like, nope, it's okay to just, if right now I'm just, I want to I want to play this way, and it might be simple or it might be sparse, and that's exactly what it should be. And that takes a level of confidence that I didn't have early on. I'm trying to do that more and more and be just comfortable with whatever it is and not what I'm trying to make it be.
Cool. Fight or Flight on Hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite tune out of all the ones I heard of yours. I really love that song. Very dark, kind of, there's an impending kind of doom underneath it, and very soundtracky, and I didn't know you'd done so many soundtracks, and I love the tom feel from the drums, really good. Tell us about that particular song, because that is a tune, that is such a good song.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's actually an interesting thing to bring up, because that album took me 10 years to release, not 10 years to record, but I recorded it in 2008 and I released it last year.
Really?
And one of the reasons I didn't release it, certainly initially, was because of songs like Fight or Flight. I recorded them and felt great, but I felt also shy, and embarrassed is not really the word, but living in New York at that time, I didn't know who to play them with or where it fit or what is this jazz? Is it, I was like, I know this is the thing that I feel like I want to make, but I don't know where to put it. And I just, you know, kind of to the last question we were talking about, I was so concerned with trying to like be a cat on the saxophone, you know what I mean? And I was just didn't have the confidence to say, oh, this, you know, right now. It was one of the reasons. There were a bunch of reasons why that took a long time. Some of the music from that record. Anyway, to just stick on that song, it's really interesting to me to see, like, now I think if you look up my name on Spotify, that's the first song that comes up.
Is it?
Right. Popularity. Okay. And it's really interesting because it was one of the things that scared me. Like, back then I was afraid of it. Like, I'm embarrassed by this song. I think the reason people like it, it's just sincere. Yeah. Not to say any others aren't. But there's something like emotionally vulnerable in that song, and what's going on there that I couldn't really handle back when I recorded. I mean, you know what I mean? I could handle it and then I recorded it, but then I was like timid. What do I don't know what to do with this, or what do I call this? Or like, I was worried about like getting attention from jazz critics and what would they say about it? All this nonsense that I could care less about now. But at the time I cared very much about. I wanted to be seen as like, I wanted people to be like, oh, this guy's like an up and coming blah 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 blah, you know, whatever. And I thought, oh, this is nobody's gonna know what to do with this song. So I had a lot of insecurity around it. But the song actually I wrote at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hotel in Chicago while I was on tour with John. I wrote it with a little keyboard inside the Reason music software. And there's something cinematic about it, you know, for sure. And I was trying to find a way to like, how do I marry these two things? Like, I love that music. I love music that has that emotional kind of quality to it that you often find in films, okay? And then like, how do I marry that with, I also wanna play in this small band improvisational context, and like something I was really trying to figure out. So that song has a lot of those elements.
It's an absolute tune. I love that.
Thank you.
Song. So you're a gifted and kind of celebrated musician. What bad habits do you have that you would teach a young musician not to do?
Oof.
If any.
You got really good questions, Chris. Tough questions. What bad habits? Well, I would say some of them are, a couple of them are evidenced in things I've titled songs or albums. So the title Can't Wait for Perfect is an ongoing struggle for me. Kind of, again, what I just talked about. I have a real hard time. I'm my own worst critic. I have a hard time getting out of my own way and trusting. I don't know if it's trusting myself, but I'm just like, I go to great lengths to protect myself as much as possible. And then, you know, because once you put something out there, it's exposed and it's an extension of yourself and people can laugh at it or, you know, I don't know. Maybe this is like comes from being a kid and moving around a lot and always being the new guy and sort of just like a fear of being picked on. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I have this definite need to like try to get things to such a high level that nobody could say anything bad about them. And it's ridiculous. It's just a ridiculous thing. So it's a, perfectionism is like a fancy word for fear. It's just hiding. Mm. I mean, in a certain way.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
details are important. And I think I'm glad to have it too, because it's been an asset, but it's equally its own liability in another way. So I don't know if it's really a habit that I would, but it's something I would advise to be cautious of. I think it's important to just do work, keep pushing, keep putting stuff out. Like, the thing is this, right? You know, how many people have you encountered, like, who would say, oh, I've got, I write all these songs, or, but it's all on a hard drive. It doesn't exist anywhere yet because it's being protected, you know? So I would caution against that. What other bad habits do I have? I don't take care of myself well enough. I don't eat. It's not that I eat bad, but I don't prioritize eating. So people are often like, dude, you look skinny. You need to eat more or whatever. Often for me, it's just like such an afterthought. I have all these other things I want to get done. And like, if I have an hour and a half, I need to get this email done. I need to get that. This has to happen, blah, blah, blah. And it's like food is an afterthought. And I'm learning as I get older, like, nope, you're starving your brain too. Yeah. It's not just, you know, and my mom will tell me that, but it's true.
What about things like technically, does saxophonists get tendonitis or anything like that?
They do. I'm pretty on that front. Not to say I'm by no means bulletproof, or not that I don't have bad habits, but I do a lot of teaching and have over the last 8 years. And I'm really diligent about being. I take the work of the craft of playing the saxophone really seriously. So when it comes to habits in that department, I'm always trying to eliminate any bad ones.
Good.
So I think I have really good habits.
And how is that? Is it warming up? Is it like not going for the?
I think it's definitely not because I practice a lot. It's that I try to be very specific and mindful, and about what it is I'm doing. So I'm a big. I focus a lot on the how more than the what. How, you know, I love the saying, how you do anything is how you do everything. And so for me, that's how you practice playing the note G sharp to A on the saxophone. It's also like, do you take care to have proper punctuation in your email?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if I see somebody who sends me an email and there's no space between sentences and the start of the sentences aren't capitalized,
yeah.
I know a lot from just that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? So, okay.
Is that professionalism?
Yeah. So is that perfectionism? Is it, you know what I mean? I don't know. It's details. Details matter. Details matter a lot to me. And it matters in the order of songs that I put on the album. I mean, I spent a year between quartet recording and release. You know, we recorded 17 songs and 8 of them are on the album. As I tell my students, that's a lot of babies I had to kill creatively. You know what I mean?
Why Crush then? Why was Crush the opening song?
It's a really strong song.
It's a great song, yeah.
It's now, I've got a few iterations of it. We did it on the Guitar Band album. That song, I don't know why or how or what, but it's an emotional song.
So that's what I wrote down here. I said it's such a beautiful, quite an emotional, reflective start to an album. So why choose to start with that?
Yeah, because when I was younger, I might have been trying to program an album to show off, like, this skill, that skill, you know, like, start with the fast thing and get up, you know, like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Now I look at it different. Like, I want to be – that song starts and I feel like you go, what's this? You lean in a little bit and then the melody starts and you lean in a bit more and it's just –
You sound very confident having that as the first song, I think. It's such a confident sounding, the fact that you're not trying to really go at it straight away in the first 30 seconds, but it's so reflecting the chord change.
Exactly. Nice. Thank you. And that's what I mean. That's a product of just maybe confidence that's come over time to be able to approach that way. The other thing you actually mentioned earlier was that I loved how that one had sounds so lush and beautiful, and then it's over. And then you hear if you didn't see it on the video and you're just hearing it, then you hear the applause. And I get chills when I hear this. Like, oh, there's an audience there, you know? So that's part of the reason also that it was first.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Okay, good stuff. So we're beginning to wrap up. Last couple of questions. What are common personality traits that set aside professional musicians making a full-time living at the music industry to those who are on the way up?
Let's see. I think that some things that I've seen across the board, some observations, let's say, I've gotten the chance to meet some of my absolute like idols, you know, yeah. Michael Brecker and Joshua Redman has now become a good friend of mine, and Chris Potter, and the guys I looked up to from a distance for a long time. And then when I met them, they just were, you know, I remember being in college and I met Joshua Redman at the Monterey Jazz Festival, and a band member of his, Ruben Rogers, who ended up later recording with me on both Can't Wait for Perfect and Hindsight. So he's the guy you hear on Fight or Flight. But he was in Josh's band, and he heard me play a side stage or something and told Josh, hey, I heard this kid and he's pretty good. I met Josh, who's like my freaking idol, and he chatted with me at the hotel bar for half an hour, and he gave me his number, and I was just like a ball of nerves. And, you know, it took me a long time, and I finally got up the nerve to call him at some point, and I came up with probably some silly question. Hey, Josh, remember me? It's Bob Reynolds. We met at the Monterey Festival, and I'm going to the studio tomorrow. I just had a question about microphones. Kind of jive. It was just like I wanted an excuse. Anyway, Josh returned my phone call less than 24 hours later.
Nice.
You know, he's somebody that was like at the top, right?
Yeah.
And then Michael Brecker was super kind and generous and giving and warm to me, and like Chris as well. Like, and then I've met lots of people who are nowhere near the caliber of those guys, who have acted like they were way above. You know what I'm saying?
Interesting.
So one quality that I've found across the board is that like the people that are the absolute best. And of course, it's not always everybody in every situation, but by and large, I've found that they've also been the kindest and most generous people. It's just been my experience, and you know, take it for what it is. Another thing is that like if you say yes to a gig, like I remember like that one of the recording sessions, and Ruben and Eric, when they showed up to rehearsal, they were early for rehearsal. And I was paying them what I could afford at the time. They were doing me probably a favor and everything. Yeah. But they said yes to the gig. They treated it as if it was like they were showing up to play in Josh's band or with Diane Reeves or whatever. Mm. They were early. Another one, Keith Carlock, a great drummer that I worked with for one of the tours in Mayer's band. And then we came off the road, and he did a gig with me in New York. And I remember, I mean, this guy's a monster. He plays with Steely Dan. He played with Sting. He played with all sorts of people. And he was early, and he learned all my music.
Wow.
And for a bar gig, a 55 bar gig, you know. So like, if you say yes to the gig, say yes all the way, and also be careful like what you're saying yes to, because saying yes to one thing, it means you're saying no to something else. So just like doing your homework is huge. Being early, you know.
Professional word.
Yeah. I was on another tour, and the drummer I had with me, this guy Jordan Pearlson, who I've done some recording with and worked a lot with. I remember we were in Spain. We did a little – it was sound check time. And he set his drums up, and just everything was right. And then he sat down, and he read a book. And I remember being like, holy shit, man. Sorry if I can't say
that. No, you can
swear.
That's fine.
Like the fact that he didn't just like, he wasn't on the drums for 20 minutes noodling around. It was my thing, and he was respectful of it. He was like, I'll come up and play him whenever you want me to, but I'm going to just chill here and be quiet while you get set up.
Yeah, nice.
Just respect, you know, awareness. I did a clinic once at Berklee College of Music with Sean Hurley, amazing bass player.
Mm-hmm.
We played in Mayer's band, but he's played with tons of people, and he's like, he's in the, I mean, he's younger than Pino, but he's going to be like, yeah, I mean, the guy's just on, he's a legend in the making. And anyway, Sean and I would have these conversations like, why did this person come and go from the band so fast and these people didn't? And oftentimes what we would see is like, some people just didn't seem to be, how did Sean phrase it? Like, they didn't have their radar up to sense the prevailing winds. It's like being able to just read a situation and read people and read what's going on and where you should fit. Where should you be right now? Should you be right up front? Should you be in the background? Is this the time to, you know, just knowing your place and awareness, again, just awareness of a situation. It's a tremendous asset to have. And a lot of people, it's not something that we were taught at Berklee in a class. And so you might think, oh, you know, or yeah, just that, like, is this the right time to hand somebody my CD and like have that conversation, or is this not the right time for that? You know, again, just thoughtfulness.
What ambitions do you have left?
Oh man.
Top two.
Top two. What I'm doing right now for the next couple of weeks, I'm just cracking the surface of doing this. It's something I've wanted to do my entire time playing the saxophone. And that is, you know, be out on a tour with my own band. Not for like, hey, it's like, look at me. It's just that I get to present the music that I care so much about with the people who can do it the most justice.
Mm.
And then to be able to share that with people, like the last couple shows we've had, it's been electric to share that. And that's really exciting. And I'm 40 and I'm just getting to do it for the first time. So that's really a big one. And the other one is to just to continue to be there for, I have two young kids, and to continue to keep the balance so that I'm, you know, that's my top priority, is being a great dad.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I feel like in some ways I'm just starting to open some of these doors that I've been trying to get at for a long time. So yeah, to keep realizing that and try to, like I was saying before, to keep being more and more true to what I'm supposed to be doing and not what I think I should be doing.
Well, thank you so much for appearing on the Stage Left podcast. Listeners can check out Bob's new album at bobreynoldsmusic.com. Is that right? That's your website. Great stuff. Thank you, Bob, for your wisdom, your insight. Play a great show tonight. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left
podcast. Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes featuring Michael Jackson guitarist Jennifer Batten, Grammy Hall of Fame inductee Steve Cropper, legendary producer Tony Visconti on the recording process of David Bowie's final album Black Star, Sum 41 bassist Cone McCaslin on working with Iggy Pop, and guitarist Billy Burnett on touring with Fleetwood Mac and Bob Dylan, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, subscribe on iTunes to get automatic downloads of new episodes, and follow us on Spotify as well. You can check our Instagram page for more behind-the-scenes material. We'll see you next time.